Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4 packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. Brad Young sitting in today. Or I actually want to quote Jackie S., who was posting on our YouTube channel, on the Annie Fry YouTube channel. She posted, and I'm quoting here, she says, quote, big fan of the Manny Fry Show, unquote. So welcome to the Manny Fry Show. Ryan Wiggins, Brad Range, Brad Young sitting in today. Glad you are with us. We've had a couple of things that were breaking news. One involves Jack Smith. We'll get to that as the show unfolds. But the thing I wanted to talk about, because it ties in with some other topics I wanted to discuss in this segment, and that is that according to various news outlets, including the BBC and others, that the parties are close, meaning Israel and Lebanon, appear close to a ceasefire deal with the Israeli cabinet set to meet tomorrow, which really will be tonight for us here in the Midwest, are scheduled to meet Tuesday to discuss it, according to both Israeli and U.S. officials. Ryan Wiggins, does this come as any shock to you that before the election, it seemed like there was no really substantive progress in these ceasefire talks, and now all of a sudden they're close to a deal? Any shock to you?
Well, two things, sort of, because we have been through this process a few times of watching them come to the table and do negotiations, but they never yielded anything. They were just sort of fluff. They were meetings for the sake of meetings, that nothing came from these meetings. So this could be that. This could be another one of those. But the way they're reporting on it suggests that maybe there's a little more substance to this one. So if there is, I think we all know why there is. Because there is a change in, I'm going to say, worldwide leadership. Because when the U.S. sneezes, the world gets a cold or whatever. That's what Brad says all the time.
Sure.
I think it's a good quote, because whenever we do something, it reverberates everywhere. We have just elected a very, very different leader to lead this country, who we saw 4 years of Middle East peace under from 2016, 2017 through 2020. So to see this now would not be a shock, that they know, things are about to change. Let's try to do it now. Let's get ahead of this thing. Let's try to hammer it out. Whether it actually happens or not remains to be seen.
Right. And you said this is Hezbollah, not Hamas?
Well, Hezbollah is the one who is, well, actually it's being announced through Lebanon. I assume it's going to cover Hezbollah in particular. As I'm looking at the BBC story, I'm not seeing that Hamas is indicated to be a part of this proposed deal, but I presume that it would be.
I mean, there's not many people left in Hamas to negotiate.
No, they've all got big gaping wounds where their pockets used to be, thanks to the exploding pager. But here's what I'm looking at, though. Historically, we have a very strong precedent for this, and that is with the Iranian hostages. Mm. Right? They were held hostage throughout most of the Carter administration, and then literally the day before, on January 19, 1981, when Ronald Reagan was being sworn in, literally I believe it was the same morning of the swearing in, the Iranian hostages were all released, and even then the news media didn't want to say why that was, but it was obvious. If you're releasing all the hostages the moments before Ronald Reagan becomes president, then the reason has to be, there's no other reason, it wasn't a coincidence, that time was chosen because they did not want to face the wrath of Ronald Reagan once he became president. And I think we're seeing something very similar play out here, because as you pointed out, Ryan, there wasn't that type of Middle East violence and warfare going on when Trump was president the first time. And I think there's concerns that what would happen if this is not resolved by January 20 of next year.
Yeah, and the weird thing about the Middle East, so putting Russia and Ukraine aside, in Iran, there are ways that you could, as a president of the United States or somebody in the Western world, although the Western world has basically no spine most of the time, Trump does. When you are the president of the United States and you're Donald Trump, you could feasibly, George W. Bush did this. There's a secularist sect and even somewhat of a Christian sect. It's not big in Iran.
Yes.
And growing, actually. So you could play to those people and say, do you want regime change? Because they do. It's a matter of historical, it's a matter of inertia. You know, the mullahs and the people in charge of Iran who are hardline Muslim extremists, they've controlled that country, like you said, basically since 1980. And so they have a lot of control there and they don't want to give it up. And there are a lot of people with a lot of reasons to keep them in charge who want to keep power. But there's a lot of like a populist kind of movement there, too, that's been going on for some time that could feasibly change the way that country operates back to a 1970s form. The it's so much harder in Palestine, though, because there really isn't that.
No.
So how do you change their leadership to somebody who'd be more friendly to Israel? You really don't.
Well, here's the thing, though. Whenever you're talking about those groups like Hezbollah and Hamas in Palestine, those are Iranian proxies. So if you
100%.
If you take care of Iran, the funding dries up, they go away. They might be there, but they won't be what they are now. And the other thing was, is under Donald Trump, you had something called the Abraham Accords. And that's where places like Saudi Arabia and these other countries were saying, you know what, we can make financial deals with Israel, and that'll be of a financial benefit to us. And that provides a check against Iranian power, because those countries don't like Iran either.
Right. But I want to come back, Brad Range, is something you just said a moment ago, and that's funding. Because I don't know, I was astounded when I read these numbers this week. But as of literally today, the Biden administration has sent $2 billion to the Palestinians. $2 billion.
Unbelievable.
Now, when you look at the fact that Hamas killed over 1,000 Jews and Americans, when you do the numbers, that works out to be approximately that the quote Palestinians, which is code word for Hamas, has been paid by the United States $2 million for every person that they executed. So they've been paid to execute Israelis, Jews, and Americans. $2 million for every person killed. And that's outrageous. So when you talk about funding, they're being funded right now, not just by Iran. Mm-hmm. They're being funded by the Biden administration, to the tune of $2 billion. And certainly, I certainly would anticipate that under the upcoming Trump administration, that funding would disappear. Because you can say from a humanitarian standpoint, we're just helping the people that have been displaced by the warfare. But we all know, everyone listening to this conversation knows, that when we send money to the quote Palestine, whatever that is, when we send them money, it's being siphoned off to buy rockets, to buy missiles, to buy axes and weapons of war that are intended to be used against Israel. And a fraction of it at most is going to actually help the people who have been displaced, not by the Israelis, but because of the Hamas and Hezbollah that are hiding behind civilians in the Gaza area and hiding behind them, hoping that we hit hospitals, hoping that Israel bombs child care centers and schools, and they're purposefully putting their own people in harm's way, and we're rewarding that behavior to the tune of $2 billion.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. The thing, and Brad said this too, if you go after the head here, if you go after Iran, and this administration has done nothing to stop Iran. In fact, they've almost encouraged Iran to just sort of keep going. They've taken away a lot of the sanctions that Trump had in place that were working. If you cut off the head, it is going to be a lot more difficult for the terrorist groups Hezbollah and Hamas to work out their terror and their wars in the Middle East. But the ideology hasn't changed. So you can't really change the leadership in Hamas, in particular, because there's not really anybody there that's like the resistance. There's nobody to turn to and be like, well, these people could lead it back to a more sane place. It's all like from cradle to grave.
Correct.
You're brainwashed to be radical.
Yeah.
But Lebanon's different, though, because Lebanon had been a secular country that has now been mostly taken over by Hezbollah.
Well, Hezbollah exists within Lebanon, but there's still like Lebanese royalty that is in charge of Lebanon.
And so there's still kind of some murky kind of, maybe that could work there. Because we're talking about long-term solutions. If we, as a nation, were much more hard line on any of this stuff long-term, they'd know, we can't just wait an administration out. We can't just wait for somebody else to get in there, wait 4 years, and it changes. They would know, America is united on this. We're never going to get any change. But they know right now that the pendulum swings back and forth so much that they can just kind of wait out a hardline president and see who's next.
Well, to me, what has been interesting from America's standpoint when it comes to October 7 was how that event, that massacre, brought out and brought to light the virulent anti-Semitism that exists not only in America, but in particular on the left. And we saw that on parade on the universities across this country, including right here at Washington University in St. Louis, where anti-Semitism came out of the closet. And it was proudly displayed for all to see. There was no hiding. There was no equivocation. They were simply and blatantly describing their anti-Semitism. But what's interesting is that now, just this past week, for the second time last week, our judge has allowed lawsuits to go forward against Harvard because of their failure and willful refusal to protect Jewish students in the midst of anti-Semitic behavior. So these lawsuits are going to go forward. Now, I believe there's up to 5 different lawsuits that are pending just against Harvard for this unchecked anti-Semitism. But the most shocking of all of this came from USC this past August, because USC had the exact same situation, where there were encampments on campus, much like what we saw during George Floyd, where they were taking over these campuses. They were discriminating against Jews. And in particular, these encampments were saying, if you want to go to your class at USC, you're Jewish, you have to renounce Israel and you have to renounce Judaism, or we will not allow you to go to school. And the university did nothing about this. So a lawsuit was filed last April, and in August, the judge actually granted relief against one of these students. And this is what the judge said, and I'm quoting here, because it is unbelievable that this happens in America. This is what Judge Scarzi said, and I'm quoting, USC has failed to uphold its constitutional obligation to Jewish students by allowing them to be excluded from parts of campus. This fact is so unimaginable and so abhorrent to our constitutional guarantees of religious freedom that it bears repeating. Jewish students were excluded from portions of USC campus because they refused to denounce their faith, unquote. And UCLA does not even dispute this.
Wow.
They don't. And the judge held that. And USC and UCLA both said, we don't dispute this was happening. But here was their defense. And this is the Harvard defense, which is not too far from the Nazi defense, where they said, well, these activities of discrimination are not being done by us. They're being done by third parties. And so we have nothing to do with it. But here's the context that drives me crazy. Let's change the facts a little bit. Let's say there were Ku Klux Klan members on the campus of Washington University who were telling people who are African Americans, you have to renounce your race and identify as white if you want to go to class. Do you think the university would step in on those circumstances?
Yeah.
So the fact that we know they would step in that circumstance, and we also know as a fact that they're not stepping in to the defense of Jewish students, is by itself evidence of discriminatory behavior. And they're fine with it. I know college campuses are fine with discriminating against people, Jewish people in particular, because of their faith and because of their ethnic and racial heritage. And in no other context would that be allowed in our country, but it is if you're Jewish. And that's outrageous. All discrimination, racial, ethnic, religious, all of that is not only morally reprehensible, but it's constitutionally prohibited. And yet our university campuses are fine with it. That was one of the lights that came out of October 7. I'm not saying it was good, but it shined the light on this virulent anti-Semitism that exists on the left today.
Let me just put an exclamation point on this because I know we got to run here. But what drives me crazy is that when lawsuits like this happen, and maybe universities are a little bit different, but essentially that's a government-funded
yes.
program that is like, well, we don't care. It's just, it's not even their money. You know, maybe they're getting endowments from somebody, but ultimately that is government taxpayer money that is going to do that and then is going to also fund this lawsuit. Like, so they're really suing the taxpayers because they didn't steward the money well at these universities and they've been discriminatory. And it's the same thing applies to all the lawfare, to Letitia James. If anything happens to these people, they go, well, it was just acting.
It's not my money.
Yeah, it's not my money.
Right. Yeah.
So who cares? So they're not really personally going to hurt and be hurt by this at all. They're just like, just throwing it into the wind. It doesn't matter.
Right. But I'm certainly glad that these lawsuits, like the two that were filed just last week against Harvard, the one that's in against USC and UCLA, which is now on appeal by UCLA and USC, are both appealing the decision that held them financially responsible for the anti-Semitic behavior on campus. They're appealing that decision. But these lawsuits are really the only way, because a left-wing mainstream media is not going to hold these universities accountable. They're not going to shine the light of the media on these acts of anti-Semitic behavior because, by and large, perhaps they agree with that behavior. And so I applaud those lawsuits bringing this to light because otherwise this is information that we simply would not have.
Yeah, it has to happen.
It has to happen. It has to happen. And I don't understand to this day what's wrong with saying discrimination is bad, period. But no, we want the left, rather, not we, the left wants selective discrimination. It's okay to discriminate against some groups, not against others. And I find that interesting because morally, that is not defensible. Morally, ethically, or legally, saying it's okay to discriminate against some, it's not okay to discriminate others. Like Harvard said, it's okay to discriminate against Asians. We have too many Asians here at our university. It's okay. If you're Asian, we're not going to let you in here. That's blatant race-based discrimination, and it took lawsuits and a case to the Supreme Court to bring that practice to an end. And I applaud the Supreme Court for doing that. Hey, it's 1:25. We've got more coming up here on the Annie Fry Show, or should I say the Manny Fry Show. Stick around, more on 97.1 FM Talk. I'm thinking it's time to grow. So I got an apartment across from the park. Parking lot in my fridge. Still I'm not feeling good. If you're all welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. Brad Young sitting in today for the vacationing Annie. And I know you all will be happy when she comes back. But in the meantime, I'm here. And the poll of the day, if you want to check out our poll of the day, I want you to go to YouTube, put in Annie Fry Show Live. And our poll today is, do any of Trump's picks give you pause? Yes or no? And that's relevant to our next conversation because joining me right now is Laura Reese. She is with the Heritage Foundation, and we're going to talk about one of Trump's picks, and in particular, border security. Laura Reese from the Heritage Foundation, welcome to 97.1 FM Talk.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
I have to tell you, Laura, one of my daily reads, I hit it every day, doesn't matter what day it is. In fact, I hit thedailysignal.com multiple times during the day. It's my favorite place to get accurate news that oftentimes is not being reported by the mainstream media. So I want to thank you personally for what the Daily Signal does literally on a daily basis for all of America. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the comments. Yeah, Daily Signal puts out a lot of content.
Yes.
And quite varied, I'd have to say. It covers stories and issues that others do not.
Well, one of the topics, and that's why I wanted to reach out to you today, Laura, is Trump's border security appointments are game changers. And in particular, I want to talk about the immigration issue. So we do know right now Tom Homan is going to be appointed to be the border czar. And how, from your perspective, is that a game changer?
Well, Tom has done this job for decades. He started out in the Border Patrol as an agent and worked his way up. He eventually was the head of ICE Enforcement and Removal Operations before becoming the acting director of ICE. And so he knows the issues. He knows the agents. The agents have confidence in Tom Homan, and their morale has lifted considerably since the election because they know someone is coming back who will actually allow them to do their jobs, release them from their desks, and go enforce the law as Congress wrote.
And I thought this was very interesting, Laura, and that is that we know that under the Trump administration, the first time, that we saw a sharp decrease in illegal border crossings. Then when Biden came into office and he eliminated all of the executive orders, we then saw a sharp rise in illegal border crossings. But simply right before the election, then we saw some of these executive orders come back. But by and large, hasn't the Biden administration pretty much been for open borders?
Absolutely. They threw open the borders day one. They halted the wall construction. They halted enrollment into the very effective Remain in Mexico program. They halted the asylum cooperative agreements we had with Central American countries, which prevented asylum country shopping, and sent a signal that our borders were open and enriched the cartels. And the historic 10.5 million illegal alien encounters, plus another over 2 million known gotaways, are evidence of what the Biden-Harris administration has done. And while the current administration made it look like they were passing some rules to tighten up the border a little bit, really they didn't. It was all for optics. It was for the election, and really any rule that they would pass, they would create so many exceptions that the exceptions swallowed the rule, and really no change in the net result of mass migration into the country.
We're talking to Laura Reese. She's with the Heritage Foundation and also writes for DailySignal.com. You should, if you don't check it out already, I implore you, check out DailySignal.com. Again, I hit it every single day. And Laura, one of the things we've talked about Tom Homan and how he's respected by the immigration and border control agents and staff because he literally came up from their ranks. But he's not the one that can do it by himself. So isn't it also the case that in addition to appointing someone strong like Tom Homan, that President Trump is also going to have to appoint, like, for example, ambassadors to Mexico who can convince the quasi-socialist government of Mexico to keep these individuals in place and not allow them to come to Mexico? Trump has to have ambassadors that have the ability to operate on a world stage, not just appoint Tom Homan and say, job done, right?
Right. Yes. Strong ambassadors in Mexico and throughout Central America are very important. We had a great ambassador, Chris Landau, during the first Trump administration, and it was one of the reasons that we were able to negotiate Remain in Mexico with the government in Mexico. It was, while that authority had been in the statute since 1996, no president prior to Donald Trump had ever used it before. And so we are going to have to negotiate with not just Mexico about restarting Remain in Mexico, but also to get Mexico to secure its southern border and other countries in Central America as well, to apply consequences to illegal immigration and to prevent so much asylum fraud, which is the go-to tool for illegal migrants to enter the U.S. and then to buy years living here. And it makes them very difficult to remove. So these countries are signatories to the asylum protocols and convention internationally. And so they need to enforce asylum laws as well, not just pass people along to the U.S. for us to have to deal with everybody.
Well, what I think a lot of people don't understand, Laura, and I'd like for you to wade in on this, is that Mexico and other Central American countries actually have a financial interest in allowing illegal immigration to the United States. First of all, it allows them to get rid of unsavory citizens that they don't have to deal with. But secondly, and perhaps more importantly, isn't it also the case that, for example, Mexico receives millions and millions of dollars a year from money that is being sent from the United States by illegal immigrants back into the country of Mexico, which boosts their own economy?
Yes. It's been a great deal for these countries for many decades. We have taken in their nationals, so these countries no longer have to worry about their employment. They send money back home in the form of remittances, which the U.S. government has not taxed or withheld. We also give these countries millions, if not billions, of dollars in foreign aid. And we also, you know, make business deals and trade deals for direct investment in those countries. It's a great deal for them. And so we need to use the many levers that the U.S. government has with respect to these other countries and say enough is enough. Our American immigration system has to be to benefit Americans. And one strong tool and enticement for these countries is nearshoring. If we want to end reliance on so many of our products being made in China, including pharmaceuticals, these countries are keen to start such businesses, grow such businesses. That means they're going to need labor. And so all of these are negotiating tools to clean up our system, but also to make our hemisphere much more productive.
Very good. Laura Rees from the Heritage Foundation. Laura, if people want to follow you in particular online or read more things from the Daily Signal, how can they find both you and the Daily Signal online?
Yes, Daily Signal is dailysignal.com. And then on Twitter or X, I am at LORA_RIES.
Very good, Laura. Thanks for joining us this afternoon on 97.1 FM Talk.
Thanks so much, Brad.
Hey, we're going to take a break here, but I want to continue with this conversation because this is not just an issue when we talk about illegal immigration. This is not just an issue that deals with the border. This is not just an issue that involves dealing with other countries. This is a domestic issue that many states and communities in our own country are literally breaking federal law, and I'm going to dive into that next on The Annie Fry Show. Brad Young, sitting in today, 97.1 FM Talk. Welcome back to The Annie Fry Show. Thanks for joining us today. Of course, Ryan Wiggins, the one in, just like I tell my kids, though, I tease you because I love you.
That's a little weird too, though.
I know, but it's a agape love, you know. It's we're
okay.
Talking about
okay.
Other kinds of love.
I'm gonna call it the Philadelphia.
Yeah, before you got
love.
Into the Greek, I was like, "This is a little weird." And then you, I'm all,
okay,
like,
"Okay, we're good."
Yeah,
he loves you like God loves his children.
Thank you.
Exactly. It's an agape love, is okay. What it is, and so I can tease you. So, but no, what isn't funny, and what I'm not going to tease is Los Angeles, because last week, the Los Angeles City Council adopted a sanctuary city ordinance that prohibits the use of city resources in immigration enforcement, including it prohibits Los Angeles from cooperating with federal immigration agents as the incoming Trump administration hints at an immigration crackdown. So, gentlemen in the room here, the topic, and I'm going to add to it here in just a moment, but how should the Trump administration respond to these cities and states? I mean, we saw one of my former law partners has retired and he moved to Martha's Vineyard. And I was teasing him before he moved because of, you know, they had four illegal immigrants that were shipped there by plane and they freaked out because there were four illegal immigrants there. But I said, wait, you're a sanctuary area. So what shouldn't you be welcoming them instead of being repulsed by them? How should the Trump administration respond to these blue cities, counties, and states that are now setting themselves up as sanctuary areas?
Well, first of all, if I'm them, I go in regardless. Like, we'll do it with or without you. You don't have to commit resources. But then I look at what sort of resources we are committing to them. Like, what sort of federal resources do those places get?
Yes.
And then I start reeling those back until they comply.
Yeah, and there's nothing legally wrong with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what the federal government, rather, has used for decades to enforce speed limits on highways. Because when an interstate goes through a state, it's up to that state to dictate what the speed limit is. But when the feds, starting in the 70s, said, oh, no, we want you to have a lower speed limit in order to save gasoline, and if you don't, we're going to withhold highway funds, then states were literally forced into compliance, even though it's a state issue, they were forced in compliance by money. Brad Range, you think that would also be an effective strategy here?
I would
here.
Leverage that. That would be my first strike.
Yes.
I would start leveraging the power of the purse. Like, I know Los Angeles doesn't gain enough in taxes to pay for all the things that they do. And so if you start pulling that back, same thing for California. I know California is one of the biggest economies in the world, but they have more money going out than they
massive
are bringing
debt.
In.
Massive debt.
And so I start leveraging that against them. It's like, all right, you don't want to do this? We're not going to give you the money. Gravy train stops.
Got it.
To me, these kind of new problems require creative solutions. I would take a step back from the whole thing and say that I was just recently in Los Angeles, and I can tell you they're doing great. There's almost no crime. There's almost no homelessness.
Wow.
Yeah, I went there.
Utopia.
Yeah, we visited Universal Studios. It was a lot of fun. And I can tell you that the media portrayal of Los Angeles is just way off. We almost never saw completely cracked out people laying on the sidewalk with all of their belongings. That's a joke. We did see some, actually quite a few. We saw a ton of them. but I just can't imagine that being a big problem there. This is a place that, you know, like Brad said, they have so much money. In fact, they have so much money that they haven't updated any of their tourist attractions since like 1985, because I was shocked to go see the Hollywood Walk of Fame, Sunset Boulevard, some of these famous places. We tried to find the Hollywood sign. That's actually much more difficult than it seems because there's all these neighborhoods you got to go through. Everywhere we went, not just those spots, but everywhere we went, it's like L.A. is trapped somewhere between 1950 and 1985. All of their stuff is really cool, but it's almost like becoming a timepiece.
Yeah.
It's weird because clearly you have a massive amount of people there. You should have a massive amount of revenue. You have tons of tourism. It's a beautiful climate. Every day, every day we woke up, it was cloudy, and then by noon, it was sunny and beautiful. Every single day was the same thing. It was my first time in California. So I'm joking about it, but this is a place that had so much potential. And they have ruined it, just like Chicago. You drive to Chicago now, you drive up Lakeshore Drive, you're like, this is amazing. And there's still a lot of activity and people out, especially if it's a nice day. It's beautiful. And they have destroyed these beautiful, vibrant places by just having crappy policy.
Exactly.
And they're doing it again. And I'm not to hit the same point, but I was shocked by how out of date LA was almost everywhere, because it was built up so quickly and so beautifully, because some of the architecture is still beautiful, but it's just like old and it's trapped. And you're like, you guys should be keeping up. You're supposed to be a very wealthy area, and they're just not.
Yeah, they were celebrating the most relevant actress was Angela Lansbury.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Starring now in Murder, She Wrote.
Like, no, I mean, some of the names on Hollywood Walk of Fame, you're like, I think I recognize some of the Christmas singers, like people that you hear only at Christmas time.
Exactly. And that's it.
You know, Loretta Lynn was one of them, but I didn't recognize most of the names.
Well, here's what I would like to see the incoming Trump administration do. I looked this up today, and under 8 U.S.C. 1324, that's 8 United States Code 1324, it's a federal statute that talks about bringing in and harboring illegal immigrants, except the statute says illegal aliens. And here's the part that I think is right on. It makes it a felony for any individual, which would include a city council, like Los Angeles City Council. It makes it a felony, and I'm reading here, quoting, quote, knowing or in reckless disregard of the fact that an alien has come to, entered, or remains in the United States in violation of law, conceals, harbors, or shields from detection, or attempts to conceal, harbor, or shield from detection any such alien in any place, including any building or any means of transportation, or encourages or induces an alien to come to, enter, or reside in the United States in violation of law. So when you look at that statute, by the Los Angeles City Council stating, number one, we're a sanctuary city. If you come here, we will not prosecute you. Number one, that's encouraging and harboring aliens to come to Los Angeles. Number two, by stating that we're not going to cooperate with any federal agencies, now you have a criminal conspiracy, which is also covered under this law, where two or more individuals are conspiring together for the purpose of violating federal law. I think it would be easy for a prosecutor, a federal prosecutor, to make the case that the entire city council of Los Angeles could be indicted under federal law simply by passing this statute. Do you think that goes too far?
Wow. No, I don't. Although, man, people are going to scream bloody murder about it if they come. The Trump administration should absolutely use these statutes, their law. They can use them.
Yes, they've been law for decades. This is not new.
And it's not just, oh, it's the letter of the law. This is the right thing to do. Now, that's debatable, but I'm telling you, it is the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do. So regardless, when you have the moral authority and the legal authority both on your side, you have to act on these things when people are getting out of line, because what the Los Angeles City Council is saying is, we are going to hurt our own citizens. We're not just going to try to, quote unquote, help these illegal immigrants. We're going to hurt our own citizens through a variety of ways that we've talked about before, not just economic, but in so many other ways that illegal immigration does not help a citizenry. So the Trump administration has to come after this. Now, they got to be careful because they don't want to start a civil war. But this is the kind of stuff that you elect a very, very hardline administration to do, is exactly that.
Yeah. Well, here's my thought on that. And this is why I would be hesitant to do that. A felony, an indictment, all of that stuff. And then to get it to actually work, you will need a conviction, which means that these people will have a right to a trial by a jury of their peers. And so you've got to go into an area where it seems like most of the people in that area are sympathetic to that cause.
But see, that's where I disagree with you, Mr. Range, and here's why. If you look at that, and I'm sorry, I forgot the proposition that just got passed 1st of November by California, rolling back all of the woke policies when it comes to crime.
38.
Theft.
Right, yeah. Because of all of the smash and grabs and all the crime. People in California are sick and tired, I think, of being taken advantage of. Because for every illegal immigrant that's welcomed into Los Angeles, that's fewer tax dollars to go for people who are there legitimately. And so I think if you phrased it to a jury that we're not just prosecuting the LA City Council because we're against illegal immigration, we're prosecuting because by reaching out to illegal immigrants, you are literally taking tax dollars that could otherwise be used to help the citizens of Los Angeles. We're giving them now to entice people to come from Mexico. And so it's harming the citizens of Los Angeles. And I think with that argument, that's like the argument of rolling back the woke criminal laws that were passed overwhelmingly, over 75% of the vote in California. I think you can make that argument legitimately, even to a Los Angeles jury.
Yeah, if you make that argument, then you would have to think that on the political side of that, you could win running for Los Angeles City Council. Like, if it were that bad, this city council wouldn't have done it because this would be poison to their reelection opportunity.
Well, I say you don't know unless you try. And I don't see any harm in doing that.
When you get into this extreme type of stuff, which is where we are, unfortunately, you have to be very, very, to borrow a phrase from the current administration, clear-eyed about what right and wrong are. Because if you're going to use the power of the law, you have to know that you are right. But this is a situation where they are right.
But you can't lose.
Totally. I understand. I'm just saying, if you're going to start doing these kinds of things, you have to be sure that you are right.
Well, part of me is more for that than deportation, and I'll tell you why. I know we're coming up on the clock here, but we have this idea of an attractive nuisance. If I have a swimming pool and a kid drowns in my pool, I'm responsible because I made it an attractive nuisance. And by Los Angeles stating that if you come here, we're going to shield you and hide you from the federal government, you are operating as an attractive nuisance to those in Mexico who are trying to flee Mexico for a better life. And the way to stop that is to hold those who are creating the attractive nuisance responsible for their actions and the ramifications of their actions. Brad Young sitting in here on the Manny Fry Show on a Monday afternoon. We'll be right back.